This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
A lot of this focused on the Navy, and not surprisingly the Navy, because this is where the main axis of confrontation with the United States is taking place, in the East China Sea and the South China Sea. And there have been recent comments from China that they see the United States on a course of containment and the United States acting in a more belligerent manner in the Pacific, and they're going to respond in kind. This will lead to a naval buildup, and I fear a naval arms race. And we just heard in the past few months that China is on its way to buying new submarines from Russia and buying advanced aircraft from Russia. This was when President Xi Jinping made his first trip abroad to Moscow in March or April, where he met with Vladimir Putin, and they apparently agreed to billions of dollars in new Russian arms transfers to China. So you see how all of this is linked together.
And in terms of Russia's arms sales to the Assad dictatorship, and Iran, of course, is joining in, and Hezbollah actually have fighters on the ground fighting in this key battle. There is no question that there's a resolve on the part of the Russians, whether it's for geopolitical reasons or just pure cynicism. They are serious, but the West doesn't seem to be quite sure about what to do. The U.S. has been ambivalent from day one about arming the rebels, and the Saudis and the Qataris are pouring arms into the worst elements in the Syrian opposition, the fundamentalist Salafists. So how do you see this Cold War developing out of the situation in Syria, given that Russia's determined to pour as many arms in as they can to ensure Assad's victory, but the United States doesn't appear to be sure about what to do?
You're right about this, and that's the nature of this new Cold War situation, where the United States is not the superpower it was 10 years ago at the end of the Cold War, when everybody talked about the U.S. as the sole superpower and there were no challengers. It seemed the U.S. could do anything it wanted. But then came the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, the virtual bankruptcy of the U.S. Treasury fighting those wars. Now the U.S. is stretched thin, and President Obama has said we have to make the Pacific our focus. And in some sense, this has exposed a weakness. Now, I'm saying this is the way I think it is seen in Moscow and in Tehran, that by shifting to the Pacific, it has made the U.S. appear weaker, less capable than it once was in the Middle East, in Syria. And I think they're saying, aha, we're going to take advantage of the weakening of America's position in the Middle East with the drawdown of U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan and so on. There's an opportunity here to strike back, to gain geopolitical advantage. And I think that's what Vladimir Putin is doing. You use the word cynical. I think this is cold, hard geopolitics of a classical kind, taking advantage of a opening that they see. Now, that doesn't mean that the U.S. is doing nothing. The U.S. is promising tens of billions of dollars in sophisticated weapons to Israel and Saudi Arabia to balance some of the sales that Russia is making.
The Cold War race, then, arms race, would be between Russia's client Syria and America's client Israel?
And Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and the United Arab Emirates, yes. So it's akin to the Cold War, very much like the era when the Soviet Union armed Iraq and Syria, and for a time Egypt, back in the day of Nasser, and the U.S. armed, of course, Israel back then, Iran under the Shah. Remember, this is the way the Cold War was played out, is the U.S. and the Soviet Union providing arms to whatever client state was on the market to get these arms. And they traded back and forth for a while. That's the way the Cold War played itself out, and it's playing itself out the same way again today.
Is this then, Michael Clare, a reaction, this new Cold War, is it a reaction to the neoconservatives and the hubris of the Cheney-Bush years, where the U.S. was the unchallenged superpower, and Paul Wolfowitz argued that now that we're the last man standing, we've got to strut our stuff and make the world in our own image. And as you know, and we all know to our chagrin, that Bush's and Cheney's misadventures in Iraq have done nothing but benefit Iran, and they've completely destroyed U.S.'s diplomatic relationships around the world, inflamed 1.2 billion Muslims, but they've also turned out to be a paper tiger, and they bankrupted the United States, and they've been completely counterproductive. So did Bush, his arrogance and his ignorance, is it coming home to roost now?
Well, there are two things going on here, Ian. There's one thing is what you're describing, is that the Bush-Cheney-Rumsfeld drive to be the superpower to end all, the new Rome, the way they thought of it. We're going to stamp, put America's stamp on the Middle East and the world for all time. That's hubris, yes. Now we're seeing the chickens come home to roost. But there's something else in play, and that is that the Obama administration, looking at this, drawing the same conclusion, is saying that for the U.S. to remain a superpower in the 21st century, it has to remain ahead of the greatest threat of all, which is China. And we're going to move our marbles from the Middle East, which is the secondary theater, to the Pacific, which is the primary theater. And we're going to remain the dominant power, no matter what, in the Pacific. That is the Obama strategy. But that has the unintended or intended consequence of pushing China into Russia's arm. And so it feeds Putin's geopolitical gain. Whether that was intended or not, I don't know. But that is the consequence of the Obama reaction to what you're describing, the setback in the Middle East.
But surely, Michael Clare, you're not suggesting that the U.S. should have not just said they were pivoting to Asia and the Pacific, that they were also going to maintain their losing position in the Middle East. I mean, reality has intruded thanks to Bush and his wasting and misuse of American power.
No, I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm suggesting something different. I'm suggesting that the worst thing we can do is to put ourselves on a collision course with China, which is what I think the Obama administration is setting us up for. That's the worst thing that we can do, because it will accelerate this trend towards a new Cold War. What I'm saying is that for the past 2 years, what Obama is doing is pushing China increasingly in a hostile, antagonistic direction. And that's bad for the United States.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Clare, the Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. He has an article at the Huffington Post and Tom Dispatch, The Cold War Redux.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrill Hurst University, the University for Grown-Ups, where it's never too late to earn a bachelor's or master's degree to achieve your dreams. Adults of all ages choose Merrill Hurst to gain knowledge from professors who practice what they teach. Now enrolling for fall term. Information at merrillhurst.edu/KBOO.
Fingers. Fingers, fingers, fingers.
A man is naked as he repeats a word over and over again.
Tune in Monday,
June 3rd
at 11 p.m.
And you will learn his story on the Ubu Hour as we bring you the audio drama Fingers.
Tune in Monday,
June 3rd
at 11 p.m. The Ubu Hour Radio Theater.
On KBOO.
Fingers. 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 Fingers.
Pride Northwest Incorporated is proud to announce its 2013 official Pride schedule of events for June 9th through 16th. We have a full week of exciting happenings designed to showcase and celebrate the LGBTQ community, including a Star Trek theme party, a special film screening, a comedy showcase, and a Tony Award-winning musical. The week will conclude with the 43rd annual Portland Pride Waterfront Festival and Parade, June 15th and 16th at Tom McCall Park. More information about the Portland Pride Festival and Parade can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. This month, several GMO wheat plants were discovered in a field in eastern Oregon. Now, planting GMO wheat has never been approved in the United States, but this rogue wheat that a farmer found growing in his field is the same strain as genetically modified wheat that was legally tested by Monsanto 12 years ago here. Does this discovery confirm the worst fears of GMO opponents? That there is no way to contain GMO crops once they are introduced to a region, and that if we don't stop GMOs now, someday they will contaminate our entire food supply? This morning, we'll learn more about the significance of this brewing GMO scandal. My guest is Clinton Lindsay, a fifth-generation farmer and local food advocate from Corvallis, who's working with the Benton County Community Rights Coalition to stop the proliferation of GMO crops in the Willamette Valley. Clint currently works for Green Willow Grains, an organic grain mill. He also is board president at Ten Rivers Food Web, a nonprofit dedicated to enhancing the local food system of the Mid-Willamette Valley. Clint, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Hi, Barbara.
Well, the last time you were on, we were talking about a measure that you're trying to get passed in Benton County, which would basically give the citizens of Benton County the right to overrule Monsanto and keep GMOs and anything else that's considered harmful out, not be able to grow them in your county. But how does this discovery that there's a possible contamination, an unintended contamination of GMO wheat, which isn't even legal in eastern Oregon, how does this kind of put into perspective your whole idea of trying to have some kind of local say over what's grown in your own county?
I think the first and most important thing is that it proves a lot of our worst fears, that the company's promises that they can control it and that it can coexist with organic and conventional agriculture is false. And that even almost a decade after they concluded field trials, the plants are popping up and nobody knows how yet. I'm told that there's USDA scientists out there combing fields, testing more, trying to find out how it got there. But it's pretty alarming that it popped up and nobody knows how. So I think this really highlights the urgency of our efforts to pass a GMO ban in Benton County.
And in Oregon and probably in the world.
Yeah, I mean, this has to start somewhere. And I think here is as good a place as any.
Well, I want to back up and like set some of the record straight, because we were both at an event Saturday night where there seemed to be a little bit of misinformation and perhaps extra and even unnecessary hysteria about what's going on. So let's talk about what has happened, and both in terms of what the discoveries were in this field in eastern Oregon and what impact it's having right now on global trade.
Okay. There was a farmer, I believe it was near Pendleton, which is a major wheat growing region in Oregon. Who sprayed a field in April and with Roundup, and it did not kill some wheat plants in that field, and he was mystified. And so he took samples of those wheat plants and he sent them to scientists at OSU who tested them and discovered that they contained Monsanto's Roundup Ready gene. And the last time that Monsanto was allowed to grow Roundup Ready wheat in Oregon was over 10 years ago. So everybody started scratching their heads. But what the immediate effects were for the business were that two of the largest wheat buyers of Northwest wheat, Japan and Korea, South Korea, immediately suspended all shipments of wheat. So, and this is just from one report in one field that has been confirmed, but I mean, this is the kind of effect that it's going to have on the industry. One discovery and their two largest buyers are putting holds on their orders. Japan's order was with a company that our farm sells to, Columbia Grain. So this is going to affect us if this sticks around.
And us meaning that you're in the Willamette Valley, right? And what, 250 miles away from this field?
Yes, that's right. So even though we're on the other side of the state, the company that we sell our conventional white wheat to, Columbia Grain, is currently not, their order for this Japanese company has been put on hold. So we don't know how long that's going to last, but that shows how drastic this situation is and how serious our buyers are about not wanting this stuff in their food supply.
Well, for people, and probably most of the listeners don't understand the mechanics of wheat farming and also of wheat selling. So let's talk about why your shipment of wheat to Asia would be affected by another farmer who is using the same distributors you are.
Well, the biggest reason is because all of these farms, most of the farms in the Northwest that ship conventional wheat, that stuff all comes down the same channels. A lot of it comes down the Columbia River, gets shipped out through Kelso or Portland, and they have no way to separate out GMO wheat from conventional or organic wheat. All of these shipments from all these farmers get mingled together in one order, one big boat, and sent overseas to Asia. So the Japanese and the Koreans know that there's a risk that if they keep buying wheat right now that it could be contaminated with GMOs, and so they immediately put a stop to it. There's no way to separate them two, and that's why we've been saying for a long time one of the immediate effects would be a disruption of the whole wheat market in the Northwest, not just for a handful of organic growers. This affects all the wheat growers.
That's what I find very interesting about this. And I was talking to you and your employer, Harry Stalford, over the weekend about the part of me that likes to be hopeful and think, well,